Hello, everybody. This is Jughead, and welcome to Jughead's Basement. I am so very happy that you could join me, and I hope you enjoy the programming. If you do enjoy the programming and you plan on sticking around for a while, I would very much like you to join our Patreon. I very much could use your help. So go to the podcast website, www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. You know, peruse the different things going on there. And then there should be a button on the right that says Patreon, and that'll whiz you to a new location where you can join and donate monthly at the $2, $5, and $10 tiers. Each tier gets you a little bit more shit and a little bit more digital shit also. You just get full of shit. What else could you want? You get a varying amount of the unedited videos of all the people that I've interviewed over the years. You also get access to some writing that I'm doing to put together a photograph and storybook called We Screeched, which has stories of my endeavors with Even in Blackout, Screeching Weasel, The Mopes, Mitochondriacs, and maybe even something about Semi-Famous near the end. Those are cool things to get for donating to the show. One of the things you can do, it is a monthly thing, but what you can do is pay for a full year all at once, and that's pretty cool. Then you don't have to think about it again, and it's like kind of giving one big donation all at once to the show, if you appreciate what I'm doing here. If you can't do that, you can also go to PayPal and actually do a one-time donation, anywhere from, let's say 2 cents to $2,000. That would be nice. I completely understand if you can't do any of that in a monetary sense. But you can do other things like share the podcast with friends and family and outcasts and underground dwellers and sharks and tabletop tennis. You can share it with a tabletop tennis. Why not? Anything to get the show out there. Let's get into it. Here we go. Right now, you are listening to I Wouldn't Dream of It by Grumpster on their 2022 record, Fever Dream. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 178 of Jughead's Basement subcategory, Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests, this week with Donnie Walsh of Grumpster and Doki Doki. On this episode, we talked to Donnie about the move from Massachusetts to California, the origin story of Grumpster, getting to maximum potential and the Gilman Street era, the move from Asian Man to Pure Noise Records on bringing in a producer, the influence of Against Me's Transgender Dysphoria Blues and Donnie's own transition, plus much, much Grumpster more! You just gave me some direction, now I'm stuck in a depression.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, let me figure out how to, here we go.
I can see you.
Hello.
Hello, Donnie. Look, my last couple interviews, the people there have been doing it outside.
It's really nice out. I was like, I could try to set it up in my room, but I have like a tiny little like dark room, or I could come have the fires, but Had to.
Well, just so you know, I always start these right from the beginning, so we're over recording. Just
Sure.
I like to be upfront about that. I like to just go from the beginning. So, Donnie, thank you for doing this. I'll say off the bat, I don't know. I've been doing this long enough where I'm not nervous, but I get a little nervous when I start interviewing someone that I have never met or,
Of course.
I just learned about. So I've done my studying, but I
Nice.
just and in general, I try to have these more of a conversation than just me throwing you a bunch of questions. I try to
Perfect.
dig a little
Nice.
deeper than just asking about, what's your favorite color and, what's your favorite venue. So I heard from you originally from the I did my interview with Lucy Giles about Doki Doki, and I really liked that project a lot. So I was excited to interview her, and I didn't know how tied Mike Park was into it.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, and how did let's just start there, and then I'm going to go back and forth. But how did you become a part of that project?
Doki.
Yeah.
So it was essentially Mike's idea, and he just like really wanted us four to like do something together.
John in the future here. Doki Doki put out a full-length record on Asian Man Records this year, 2023. The band members include Lucy Giles, drums and vocals, Logan Hammond, guitar and vocals, Donnie Walsh, bass and vocals, and Randy Moore, guitar and vocals. Back to Donnie.
So he just like hit us up one by one. He was like, "So, like, when could you go into the studio to like record this thing?" And we were all like, "Huh?" And then we just like surveyed, and then we went in there and we recorded the songs, and yeah, there it is.
Yeah, so you got in, I mean, you got involved with Mike because he put out your first full-length record.
He did, yes.
John in the future here again. I don't plan on interrupting this many times, but my questioning was sort of sporadic at the beginning here. So I'll fill in that Donnie's full-time band is Grumpster, and they released an album called Underwhelmed, their debut album, on November 8th, 2019 on Asian Man Records. Well, how did you forge that connection with Mike?
So if I'm remembering everything correctly, I feel like all of us have like different versions of how everything went down. But I'm pretty sure what happened was we were putting out our second EP is called Cutting Ties. And then our friend Joey, who is actually like our tour manager now, like permanent squad member, she used to volunteer at Asian Man. And so he showed Mike Grumpster, and then we started to hear from like friends here and there. They'd be like, "Mike from Asian Man called me yesterday and like asked like what we know about you guys." Like other friends who were like in the scene and in bands were like, "What?" He, I think, reached out to us to record at District, which is where we made Underwhelmed and then our next album. I think that's how we got in direct contact with him, I'm pretty sure. And then we recorded the album there. And then there was some conversation, I forget exactly how, but came to be that he put it out, and we've been friends ever since.
Yeah, I'm always very impressed with Mike because he still reaches, and what I mean, I try to too, but we're older men's of the scene, so we've been around for a while, and sometimes it's harder to try to keep in contact with what's going on now in younger generations. And I'm pretty proud of him for being able to do that. And it also takes a lot of guts, because now we're a little bit, I don't know how to say this, but out of it ourselves, not as contact with it. So it makes it a little bit more of a challenge to try to get the guttural fortitude to approach younger people and see what's going on in the world. So I admire him for doing that.
Yeah, it's cool because I feel like he like maintains friendships with his bands like always. Like you never hear a story of Mike having like bad blood with anybody, like bands that he's signed. Like he's friends with all of us, and he knows people in the scene. Everyone knows like younger people, so he has so many ways of like finding new bands.
And we're going to return to that because I want to get to the first record. But now I'm going to go back. You originally were from Salem, Massachusetts,
Yeah, true.
one of my favorite places to visit in the fall time.
Oh, really? Salem
Yes.
specifically or just Massachusetts?
Yeah, so, well, my drummer from Even and Blackouts lives in Boston. So
Oh.
whenever we go to record with him, we would always go up to or down or across to Salem.
Oh, So beautiful.
Yeah, and we would, I don't know what road that is, but there's a road you could take from Boston to there that goes along the water that's really beautiful all the way
Oh,
to,
in like
yeah.
Swampscott and
Yeah,
shit.
yeah.
Yep, I used to drive that all the time just for fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Now that I'm like so removed from it, I really appreciate like the beauty there. It's really awesome.
Did you feel like you needed to, what age were you, and did you feel like you needed to get out of there? Was it no longer home for you?
I was 19 years old.
At 19, Donnie moved from Salem, Massachusetts to Oakland, California.
Yeah, I just wanted to go. I was like, I gotta go do something else. And so I came like far and it worked out, which is
What
good.
that is about as far as you can go without leaving the continental US, so right,
Yeah,
which
it
is
was literally coast to coast. It's like ping.
yeah, I read a little bit about that. Like, you, I think you went there with a friend and then you liked it and then you just packed up and
Yep.
moved.
Yeah, as soon as we got home, I was like, I'm just gonna move there and like figure
This might be a weird question from someone who's now in Japan now, because I've gone
it
across the world, but I've always been a homebody. Like, I've always had the same. You know, I stayed home with my mom. You know, she was divorced, but till like 23. And then
Ooh.
I lived with my friend from high school. I still own a house with him in Chicago to this very day. So the idea of going like that far and so young is scary to me. What did you, were you dealing with some demons and some fears, or?
Honestly, not really. I kind of just like did it and had faith that it would work out. And I was just
Yeah.
like, this is what I'm gonna do. This is what I want to do. And then I just like am here now.
Were you already driven at that point to be in a band, or were you in bands in Salem too, or?
So I think it's when I was in eighth grade. They did like a end of the year. Like I was always in like concert band and stuff in school. And then at the end of eighth grade, I believe. During the like last band concert of the year, I got to like put together a little band and like play a song that I wrote.
Yeah.
So like I if that could be considered a band, I guess so, but it's just one performance. So I tried, but it wasn't till I came out here that it really worked.
I guess what I'm getting at, I'm wondering is was that maybe a little bit of the security of moving away? Did you have it in your mind that, like, the drive to get a band going, or was that something that accidentally started happening when you were there?
Oh no, it was on purpose.
Yeah.
It was calculated. I wanted to do it here.
Yeah, you, I think you had been a fan of the Gilman scene already
Yep.
for a long time. Yeah.
So many East Bay bands. Yeah.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
I was like, well, I mean, that looks fun. I could do that
Yeah.
too.
Well, I guess it's not as hard to discover punk rock, probably, especially in Massachusetts, your age. But what was it that clinched it for you, that type of music style?
Oh, you know, I remember the exact moment. I was like, that is awesome and I want to do it. We were like snowed into a hotel once and it was New Year's Eve. And I remember like the TV was on and it was Green Day playing Know Your Enemy. And I was like, that kind of music sounds so good. What is that? Do you know the enemy? Do you know your enemy? Well, God, I know the enemy. And then I like ran into my hotel room and I like went on my laptop and I looked it up and I heard all the songs. I was like, what? I have never heard anything that sounds like this before. And then, yeah, it was just never the same after that.
And did you go down like a rabbit hole of finding a bunch of other bands that were
Yeah.
connected? Like, yeah.
Right away, just on YouTube. Before that, her album had been Queen's Greatest Hits. So I liked rock music, but it was just different.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm not, Queen is one of my favorite bands of all time. And I remember when
Screeching Weasel first started doing interviews like in 87, I made it my job as the band member to say something different than the Ramones. So like everyone would say the Ramones and I'd say either Jethro Tull or Queen.
Nice.
And at that time, you know, you just didn't hear Queen on the radio, except for maybe,
really?
Yeah, no, not at all. Bohemian Rhapsody started playing a little bit. And then years later when it was on Wayne's World, it made it big again. But in America, you didn't hear Queen on the radio until like Another One Bites the Dust was the first like big hit.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But anyway, I love music. Yeah. So are you still listening to Queen? Do you still listen to those old records?
Sometimes I do. I did for a while, and I can still do it kind of poorly. I can play that first guitar solo in Bohemian Rhapsody on a guitar.
Ah.
Just saying.
Well,
it's
yeah.
Not great, but I can do it.
Yeah, some of that playing is pretty intense. I don't know if you know this too, but Brian May, who is the guitarist, him and his father made his first guitar, that, and he used that guitar through all of the bands, through all of the records. Yeah.
For real? Aww.
Yeah, and actually, a lot of interviews during the day were like, how you get that sound you get? Because there was no like pedal that would do what he was doing.
He's like,
and
I don't know.
Him and his father were electricians, and they built their own like kind of pedals right into the guitar.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, he's actually a scientist. I think he's an astrophysicist, Brian May, the guitarist.
Don't understand that at all.
Yeah. But that's something I've been thinking about lately, because going, and even still to this day, you don't see it as much, but every time like a punk used to be on TV, it was them like breaking cans or robbing stores or something. How do you feel, and do you think you help prove that punk is more than that, that there's a complexity to it that people underrate sometimes? Or do you feel like that really exists still?
Well, I don't know. I feel like a lot of people who are like punks are just like nice. Like they just want to do good, you know? So it's like the image that you, it's like, that's not it. Everyone just wants to be nice and help each other. I mean, at least that's what I think of it.
Yeah. But it has an aggressiveness. Whenever I have talked to someone who started like their early hardcore scene, I talk to them about that. Wow, how does this music have such an aggression? But it seems like there's so much love involved in the scene too. And some of them are not able to answer that because they actually feel bad about the, like I talked to the guy from Toxic Reasons, which is one of the first hardcore bands. And he talks about how he just feels bad that a lot of violence would happen because of their shows, but he was there to unite people. I just think that's an interesting contradiction.
You know why? I think because sometimes, especially at those kind of shows, and this is true, it does happen, but some people get like carried away in the pits. Like they could go there to blow off steam, and once they start swinging, they like lose control, you know? So I think that gets like blown out of proportion, and also probably like eggs other people on to like join the chaos. And then it's just like, so in that regard, like, I get it, but it's like there's so many different kinds of people everywhere.
Yeah. So out of the bat, when you first formed the band, did you fall into a category of playing shows? That's another thing I'm curious about. Did you find yourself playing mostly with pop punk bands?
We honestly played a lot with just like our friends' bands who are mostly like part of like the Gilman scene. I guess so, kind of, yeah, like. Other like local punk bands of like similar sound for a long time. Yeah. For probably the first like 1 to 3 years. I have like a pretty bad sense of time, but yeah, for a while it was the same groups of bands. It was very fun.
Yeah. I always talk about my history is nonlinear, because that's the best way I remember things. It's just more about places and smells and people instead of like dates.
Yeah, exactly. Like tons, eras.
Yeah. So did you have some strikeouts in forming the band, or did it just seem a bit magical to get to like, I think Lalo and Alex came on pretty early, right? Or Noel, I'm sorry, Noel and Lalo, right? Alex came in later, right?
Yeah. Alex is a later addition, but it was pretty good almost right off the bat. Like at first, so essentially Lalo and Noel worked together and had like loosely talked about starting a band, and then Noel like left that job, and then I got hired there. We missed each other by like 2 weeks, and then Lalo and I met, and then right off the bat me and Lalo were like, like, we need to be in a band together. So we did. And then we had like a fill-in drummer at first who was just like, he was doing it because he was our friend. He was not having a good time there. And then we practiced with Noel. And then at first we didn't think it was going to work out. It was kind of crazy right off the bat. And then we're like, just slow down a little bit. And like, can you just like do it a little bit like this? And once he tweaked it, perfect. No issues ever since.
Oh, that's actually a question I have for you, Donnie, because I actually saw that in like a couple press releases and also in reviews about that specific moment of asking him to slow things down. And that's how it cemented it. And that's, I guess that's an interesting thing to me too, because it implies to me that you had a goal in mind already, like a speed that you wanted. And I think that, I don't know. I just find that as an interesting thing to have like in press releases and stuff. What can you expound on that like idea?
Yeah. And it's funny too, because me and Lalo felt the same exact way about it. We reacted the same. We like looked at each other and we were like, what do we do? Like, what? But I think it's because like we had been like making demos together and like sharing songs and stuff like that, like prior to that practice. So we, I think together knew like what we wanted to sound like. And so I think it was just a matter of being like, he was playing the parts he was playing well, but it just didn't fit with like, I guess the sound that we wanted Grumpster to have. So, and we knew he could do it too. Cause we're like, we know what kind of music you like just tweak it a little bit. And it was perfect.
Me in particular, but having watched, like when I started Weezer and watching Ben deal with drummers, because me and him didn't know anything. We hardly knew anything about guitars. It's interesting to try to figure out a language for drummers, like how to, sometimes you end up like tapping on their cymbals or hitting on their drum. But did you just say slow down, or did you have to find like a way to say that? Or like,
it's funny that you say that, because even like in today's age when we all have like such good like chemistry playing together, sometimes at practice he's just like, I don't know what you guys are telling me. We're like, just do this. He's like, it doesn't make sense the way you're describing things, which is funny. But in that moment, no, we were literally just like play a slower, like still a fun beat, just like not like a like a, no blast beats. Don't do that. And then he was like, oh, and then as soon as he played it, it was like,
So he felt it too. Like once it may have gelled with the songs.
Oh, yeah. And then at the end of that practice, we were like, wow, we got some songs ready.
I keyed into that also because being a songwriter and for like 30 years and experiencing it, there is that weird even though when you play live, you always play faster. But when you're creating a song, it has a speed that if it go too fast or too slow, it changes like the feel of it, like the intention of it.
I know.
It's hard to talk about that because it's so like instinctual or like a feeling oriented thing, you know?
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I've actually been having this experience recently. That's a cool thing, but is similar to what you just said, where for our new album that we're writing, I'll be in my room and I just make like a little like demo on my acoustic guitar and it's like slow and quiet, and then we bring it to the band and we like blow it up into this big huge crazy song. And it's been really cool because I'm like writing the demos and I kind of only know what the melody is going to sound like, you know, and then once I bring it to practice and it's just like blown up by everybody, it's a completely different song that we don't even know existed until we all make it.
I love hearing people talk about that. I talked about that, I can't remember who recently I interviewed, but the idea of musicians who want to be in an ensemble and then people that are more like megalomaniacs who just want people to come in and do what they say. But I think the beautiful thing about the unexpected is, like you're saying, create something in your room or by yourself and then bringing it to other people and see how it changes and alters. That's exciting to me.
It's so exciting. Yeah. And it's like, that's, I don't know, I feel like that's how you can get to your maximum potential. I mean, like some projects work if it's like one person spearheading it. If that works for you, awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
But having like four brains working on something instead of just one, so much better.
It's funny because once after that interview with Lucy, I was like, oh, I want to reach out to Donnie. And I did. But once I started studying, I'm like, oh, this is... at least like Lalo, I knew it seemed like it was much more of a writing team than I had expected. It sounds like you do most of the lyrics, though. Is that true? Or
yes. So really, it's like not anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Up until this point, I did all of the lyrics. On our next album, Alex has some songs as well. They will also be writing. But yeah, usually we all like write our own parts completely. So like some people have like a chord progression or like a little bit of a song and then just like teach it to the others. But everybody, like the parts that you hear is what everyone writes on them. Very collaborative.
Yeah, once I started watching the videos and some of the concerts and listening to music, I really started enjoying Lalo's guitar playing. Like he's very good.
I love it.
I one of the things I wanted to say is I don't usually talk about the names because I like just getting to know people instead of talking about those questions like names. But I thought it was very interesting once I started studying you and realized, you know, there's a lot of band names where, you know, in Google, thousands of things will show up. But actually, when you put in Grumpster, you're pretty much the only thing that shows up, which is kind of cool. And I'll tell you, I know where it was. It was, I think it was Lalo's mother used to call him a grumpster. Is that right? Or is it Lalo? Or is it? Yeah. Yeah.
You studied. I love it.
I try to. So let's do that. You put a band together. Gilman Street is, I mean, I imagine my whole audience knows Gilman Street because that's, I mean,
who
that's.
To those who live it, punk rock is something more. It is a conversation with society.
San Francisco, I think at one point, it's probably the strongest scene in America.
All of a sudden, like, all these bands just start popping up.
The bands that we were excited about were our East Bay bands.
It had an important place in the pantheon of punk. It was about playing honest music.
Like, it wasn't hard like punk rock was supposed to be.
It wasn't always about the band that was playing on stage. It was equally about what was happening in the audience.
Punk rock club opened up in my neighborhood. I jumped on a bus the next day and I headed back home.
People remember it as being a starting point to the East Bay scene.
Gilman Street, you had a co-op.
You didn't have any of that in LA. Nobody trusted anybody.
It was a great hub for all the bands to go to.
This was what was gonna be it for another generation.
Punk was getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
It's an underground punk scene. It's meant to thrive in this environment.
Punk rock isn't a sound. It's doing something you're afraid of doing.
That's the East Bay sound.
Turn it around, the story of East Bay punk.
Was that one of the main places you played? Were you like an opener a lot for bands?
Honestly, it's kind of funny. Our first show as a band ever was at Gilman, and we didn't even open. I think we played third. But yeah, we like once we started playing Gilman, we were playing all the time. It was awesome.
Yeah. Did you feel? I don't know. Did you feel right? Did you feel at home? Did you feel you were in where you belonged?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everything about our like Gilman era, I'll call it, when we were playing there all the time, it felt really good. Really good shows. Everyone who came to the shows are also good, and all the bands we were playing with. So the whole scene around that time is really awesome here.
And did that give you are we talking around, I think, 2017? Give me the date of where we're talking around. Is that about right?
2017, maybe 2018, but definitely.
Yeah, you had some like, it looks, there's this thing, I'm looking at Discogs that is not on a label, Funeral Tunes.
Oh, yeah, that was our very first EP ever.
Yeah, that's 2017, so around there. And then, yeah.
Dude, we took that down off of everything, because there was like one day we were just like, I just don't want people looking it up and finding that. So we like took it down everywhere, but someone uploaded it to YouTube.
You know, we're in the modern age where your past just doesn't ever really go away. It's always tucked away somewhere. Well, I mean, I always find that interesting because I guess maybe it's because, I don't know, I'm a writer and I love philosophy, and I don't ever really look at the things I did in the past. I mean, like creative stuff and like grimace at it or not. I guess, I mean, I could say, yeah, I like to see where I've improved, but I don't really have that reaction like Ben does, and a couple other musicians I've worked with like can't stand listening to their older stuff. But
yeah,
I like it. Is it just that one in particular, you think? Was it a little bit too not knowing what you were doing?
Honestly, like nowadays it's like kind of cute, to be honest. But at the time, I think we were just like figuring it out so fast that we felt like we were like, this doesn't even sound like us anymore. Like, we have to take it down. Mm-hmm. And it, like, every album you put out is going to sound different than the last one.
As a creator, do you find yourself looking back at your, using your past to inspire you forward? Like, from some of the interviews, it does sound like you do deal on some level of conceptual work. Like, you do like a continuing theme or continuing something going on within the band.
No, honestly, not really. Especially with like the stuff we're writing, it's just like a new slate kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, I feel like, feels conceptual because like I feel like I write a lot of songs like all at the same time, so they're all happening like one like phase of like things that are going on, but other than that, yeah, like once we put something out, it's like, okay, that's done, what's next?
Yeah, but are you a performer enough to do you enjoy playing your old songs live still? It's like it becomes a different thing then, or what, how is that?
Some of them sound like pretty cool. We like play in a different tuning and stuff now. And we have Alex singing some songs now and doing like backups and stuff. So a few of the old songs like work and sound really good. Honestly, some of them just don't sound good anymore. They're like hard for me to sing, you know, or I like don't like relate to them, you know? So I'm like, I don't want to play something that I don't like wholeheartedly like feel, you know, cause that's so much of it.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that's being very connected to your music. You're one of the first persons to say that to me, I think, where I agree with your choice.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I would want to play like, I don't know, just songs about stuff I don't care about. I don't like.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess for me, it's about that audience relationship. And I think some big part of my brain just goes to that, like enjoying the reaction that I'm getting from it and acknowledging that they might still be going through that stuff, you know? Or something
Yeah. Yeah. And there's like, if there's like old songs that people like really like, they're like, I need to hear this. It's like, you know, there's some songs where like, oh, we can't take that one out. Like people come to see that song. So there's a few that are like that, but I just like to do little bits or like make people dance so that it's like stuff.
Yeah. Is then performing a big part of it for you? Is that like a huge part of the job?
Yeah. Yeah. It's all like equally as fun, but definitely like playing shows and like being on tour. I love it. Recording is also fun. Writing songs is fun, but yeah.
Yeah. Cause I was trying to find a couple of your like YouTube interviews and most of them are in a van.
Yeah, we were always doing them on the go. We'd be like scheduling around like drives and shit. Just like, we're like, oh, people want to talk. Like, we want to talk. Like, we just like pull over on the side of the road, be like doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere that you, from Chris too, that you got advice about how to get along in a band or in a group, right?
It was from Mike Park. And I think it was to always like be honest with each other, I think was his like big thing. He was like, as long as like, oh, always be honest with each other and always talk things out. That was his advice.
Yeah. Did you find yourself reflecting on that on the road when like, were there any?
Not all the time. Yeah. But we honestly, we get along pretty well.
Yeah. Three or four people in a van, there's bound to be, you know, there's, I mean, it's like you become a family and families are always, there's a little bit of conflict. There's conflict in love. People don't like to admit it, but it's true.
Yes. It's mostly just like, like people get grumpy, but that happens anyway. So yeah, that's the worst.
So is that a goal to be on the road quite a bit?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. The only thing that makes me sad about it is leaving my dog here at home. I think about that a lot, but it is a big goal. Yeah. We're doing some tours at the end of this year, which is exciting. And then hopefully after we release our next album, we can just like do a lot.
Yeah, because it seems like a lot of the bubbling excitement about the band happened during the pandemic time. So that made it probably even more wanting to get out, you know, afterwards.
We were set to do our first like full US too. And then the pandemic hit. It was going to be in May. And then pandemic hit in March. But we toured like kind of right off the bat. As soon as things opened, we were out. And I think we did like three full US's in that time.
Let's get into a little bit. I want to base a few things around talking about the two full lengths, but there's going to be questions that are unrelated to that, I think.
Yeah.
So the first one was Underwhelmed, right?
Yeah.
was the idea of doing a full length, was that was just in the cards, right? I mean, it seemed.
Yes, absolutely.
So did you all plan to do that with Mike, or how did that come about?
We didn't, or I mean, we wanted to, obviously, but like, you don't know till you make something.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I'm pretty sure what happened was Mike contacted us about booking time at District Recording. Oh no, you know who it was? I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
Reached out to us and was like, you should book time at District Recording. I'll get you in contact with Mike. And we had heard that Mike liked Grumster through Joey, and then he helped us coordinate the time for Underwhelmed. And then once it was finally done, I'm pretty sure we sent it to him and he was like, down to put it out. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, yeah. Can you say the, something happened with the internet? Can you just say the person that contacted you first, or was the connection? That one name got bleeped out somehow.
Aaron from Lorne Records.
John in the future here. To clarify this, we are talking about Aaron Kovacs of the label Lorne Records, which was established in March of 2011 out of Corona, California.
There you go. Okay, Lorne Records. Okay. How does, I don't know how to put this in a question, but I'm always interested in the dynamics of being in the studio. Like who, like I was the one who gravitated towards being in the room all the time. Like I just love being at that engineer board, you know, even though I didn't really understand it much. That was kind of the thing that I love being right there. Then there's some people that like to just do their part and then just sit in the back. What are the dynamics of your band? Like, how does that work?
We all like to be in there, like for sure, the whole time. We'll take breaks and like run to the store and like get some drinks or some snacks and come back, like little walks and breaks here and there. But usually, yeah, if someone's like working, we're all like, we're in there together. Yeah.
Now you brought Alex in, but was there a point where were you doing some of the guitar too?
The first one is all Lalo, like layering and stuff. And then on the second one, I believe it's Lalo. And I know Chris also played a few parts. I'm pretty sure. But yeah, and then Alex has only recorded on the new song that came out recently.
Is that Hollow? Is that right? Is that the one?
Yep. Or,
okay, cool. Yeah, well, that was a question I had too. What was the, we probably might have answered in looking back already without actually speaking about this one, but you re-recorded Cairo. Emotions overwhelming and I don't think I'm okay. Is that because that was something you did live and your voice was different, so you wanted to re-record, or is there something about the lyrics or something that resonated still? Or
just kind of like, we were trying to figure out a song that would be cool to re-record like alongside Hollow, and we were like, well, everything from Fever Dream is like too new to redo, mm-hmm. because that just came out. And then for Underwhelmed, I think we talked about maybe doing like a 5-year anniversary like re-recording of that album, which would be cool. I think that was like in the talk, so we were like, let's not do one of those songs. And then Kairos was like the only other old song that I could still sing and in the new tuning. So we just decided to do that. And it's kind of like a fan favorite.
And video making, was that just a given that would move into that? I that's another thing I talk about too, because like I'm from the age when the punks were a little bit against videos in general. And now it's like, they come hand in hand. Like some people don't even do distribute music. They just do music videos, you know?
Yeah.
Is that an important part of your image for the band or yourself to do videos?
I would say so, yeah. I really like making videos, and like the Hollow music video, I had like an idea for it and like gave it to our friend and then he just like executed it. Mm-hmm. So that was like, really cool to kind of like be in the process a little bit. But I think, videos are important. It's a good representation of everything. And like, it's fun, like, to watch videos from like your favorite bands, you know, you're like, oh my God, I wonder what their music videos are like. You love to watch that stuff. Mm-hmm. So let's make that for people who like us.
Yeah. Do you, this once again is, I think all ways work well, but do you conceptually try to tie it to the video, or is it just the creativity runs wild and you have some idea.
Yeah, I feel like it, at least for the Hollow video, is kind of just like a random idea that like popped into my head, and I was like, that would be a cool video for this song. But I know like some videos, like there's like a script for, or like references for, and like more kind of like chiseled out ideas. Sometimes it just like pops into your head and you're like, oh, that would be cool.
And then you moved to Pure Noise Records.
Yep.
Next. Was that a, it seems like you still have a relationship with Mike. So, and he often pushes people to their next step. So that I imagine that was a very not conflicted change, or was it?
Yeah, no, it was like, I remember the moment so vividly when we, I think it's like when we decided that we were going to sign to Pure Noise. I remember I like went for a walk in the neighborhood, and then the band was like, you got to call Mike and tell him that we're going to, or it's when we were going to start shopping the record.
Yeah.
But we knew we were going to like send it to them. And they were like, you got to call Mike and tell him that we're going to like shop the record elsewhere. And I was like, oh my God. Like, it felt like if you're just like, mom and dad, like, thank you for everything, but like, I'm going to move out. It felt so sad. So I just remember like walking, and I like called him, and I was kind of like, and I had to leave a voicemail. I was like, please call me back. We're trying to tell you something. It probably sounded like some emergency was going on. But he like, yeah, called back, and I told him, and he was just like, dude, like, that's so awesome. Like, I want everyone to do good. Like, yeah, he was so happy for us. I was so sad, but it all worked out.
And you stayed at that same studio that he pushes often.
Yep, we did.
So you had Chris number two come in and help work out on the record. How did that relation start?
John in the future here, Chris Barker, better known as Chris number two, was the bass player and co-vocalist of Anti-Flag.
It was like, we did a live stream during the pandemic, and he was like you know how like when you do a live stream, like you can like talk to the people on it. He was like, ha, like, let me produce your record. Well, we're like, what? So I remember we were like, are you serious? And he told us that he had emailed Mike about it. And Mike was just like, I don't know. Like, so then Chris asked us, or we asked him, and then he was like, yeah, I want to. And then kind of right off the bat, like, we like discussed his process, started like making demos. We'd like send them back and forth, like Zoom, talk about it. And then he came out here, produced it. It was very fun.
Yeah, sometimes when someone says they produce something, they're just sitting there and you're doing what you do, and they're just helping out, putting money in and stuff. But was he like hands on with the band?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It was like, it was kind of like he was like joining us for the week, because it's like we would like show him the songs and he'd be like, oh, here's all these things that are really good about it. These are the things that I would change about it. What do you think? You know, and then we would consider what he said, rework things if we wanted to, until we felt like it was like at as good as it could be. And then same in the studio too. We'd have ideas and he'd be like, have you thought about doing this? Blah, 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 blah. And it's like, oh, cool.
Of course.
And then we go home every night. We could listen to the mixes. It's very fun.
Sometimes I mix in songs during the interview. So do you have I'll give you a moment to think about this if you have to. Do you have a specific song or moment that he had given an advice that you guys went with and it really did change the song?
The song Better Than Dead. It's been so bad. It had a completely different structure before he got his hands on it. And then honestly, for the first like couple weeks after we like rearranged it to what he thought, we were like, how do we tell him that we think our version is actually better? And we were like freaking out, and he was like, trust me, this is the way it should be arranged. We were like, and then once we like got it and then got in the studio and recorded it, we were like, wow, if we had done it our way, it would have been so much worse.
That sort of relationship I'm always impressed with. Cause I mean, I was part of, I'm a theater company in Chicago for 20 years. And basically we all write every week about our lives, but we have to present them to each other. They're like short 2-minute plays. And then you direct them yourself, but everyone else can put in advice. And one of the big lessons we learn is how to say yes and no to people. And it's a really difficult thing, because you want to protect your thing, or the other side, you want to please everybody, and then you end up diluting what you originally came in. So I think that relationship of working with the producer is really interesting. Yeah. And the more confidence you have as a musician, the better the relationship works, I think.
It teaches you a lot about like working with other people, because that was the first time that anybody had been like allowed like into the band, mm-hmm. you know, where it, like, oh, here's a person who like hasn't been here through it all, like isn't in the band, but has opinions on things, but wants to help, is here for good. You know what I mean? And so learning to like let go of some of your ideas where you're like, but I want to play it that way. If it really does sound better a different way, you know, you learn, but happy to have.
And it expands your own knowledge if you open yourself up to it. Once again, like opening up to an ensemble, opening up to that sort of relationship opens up the view of your music.
Exactly. And now when we like think about like having producers and stuff, we're like, who's it going to be? We're like, who's so that's like, it's fun to know kind of like what a producer's role is now. So like going into like the next records, it's like, you know who you are.
I imagine Pure Noise probably helped with, it seems like there was a little bit more, because they probably have a little bit more machine behind them. Mike is sort of like a fatherly, inspiring bands. And then Pure Noise probably put a little bit more budget into, or at least getting you interviews and stuff. It seemed like it boosted up quite a bit from there. The record itself is pretty great. I listened to that one a lot. I just wanted to know.
It was very fun to make.
Yeah. So how were you surprised at all by the reaction you're getting from it? I mean, because sometimes you're so involved in a project, you think it's great, but you really don't know if it's like good or not.
It is pretty crazy, just like the fact that people like care. I'm like, but you know, huh? Like I was talking to one of my friends the other day and I was like, we were just talking about like the new album coming out, and they were like, well, I mean, I'd say you could just delete all the old stuff if nobody cared, but people do. And I was like, I know, it's so odd. It's like, it's crazy to me. Yeah, but very, very grateful for that.
Yeah. So just so the audience, as we're talking about, the second record is Fever Dream.
Yep.
Came out in 2022, and that was recorded at, what's it called again? District Sound? Is that a district?
Yep. Same place we did it.
Cool. And I guess the other thing I'll say is that you are allowing yourself to talk about some very personal stuff, but as a writer, you have to put it in a context where people can relate to it. So that must have been interesting too, just to put your heart into that stuff and then have it accepted.
Yeah. I think like, I like doing it that way though, and putting it out there and people can like listen to it and like, is infer a word, or they kind of just like have their own idea of like what it means and like what it's talking about. I would much rather give myself out that way than literally be like, this song is about one time when I'm like, I don't want to talk about it like that. But if people listen to it and like interpret it in different ways, that's how I like to do it.
This next section I'll go into now, I did read one of your interviews where they had each of the band members say people that and records that influenced them. And you did talk about Against Me and Transgender Dysphoria Blues.
Yep. You want them to notice, bring it and feel so much less. You want them to say you like to see if the other girl, they just see your baggage. Other than that, they can trust it. Rest upon the trust of which you get us in the whole day alone. About allowing you to maybe bridge the gap into writing about personal stuff like that.
Yeah. So Donnie, I'm going to go into a series of questions where I'm admitting off the bat that I don't always have the proper words to talk about transgender. So I just want to tell you that for it. And if you're okay with talking about a bunch of different questions and a lot of mine is just curiosity too, but
no, absolutely.
You're okay, cool. Right. So that was that. Oh, you were probably already dealing with that openly by Ben before listening to that record. What did that do to you hearing that? And I don't know what the question is right here.
Yeah.
But it did seem like you were affected by that and allowed you to deal with what you were going through as a person.
Yeah. Well, it was also really helpful. I got into that album around the same time. that I read Laura Jane Grace's book.
In November of 2016, Laura Jane Grace, the singer for Against Me, released a book called Tranny, Confessions of Punk Rock's Most Infamous Anarchist Sellout.
I was also just like it, experiencing all my own things and whatever, and we were like writing for the album, and then yeah, just like taking in all of that and really like sitting with it and like thinking about it kind of like inspired me to try to put into words like what I was experiencing. So that's why like a few of the songs on Fever Dream are actually about that stuff. And it was like right around that same time when I was like, huh, I'm like, look how she's doing it. I'm like, I could write some songs, get this off my chest.
Yeah. We already committed to a path to become trans man at that time.
Yeah, when I read that book, I was recovering from my top surgery, and I had just started taking testosterone as well, like the prior month. So I was just like really starting the process around that time. And like when we went into the studio for Fever Dream at first, like, yeah, that's when I was really starting to do things about it, grapple with it.
Yeah. Once again, curiosity, you don't have to answer if you want, but this does, it affects the dynamics of a band. I imagine they love you. So it's like whatever Donnie needs to go through, Donnie goes through. But were there discussions of what you were going through?
Like kind of, but it's just been like getting better ever since I started. Like everything has just improved. And so it's kind of, I told everyone, they were like, yeah, we knew. I'm like, okay. And then I started doing things about it. The hardest thing was when I started testosterone, because at first I was going to try not to. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm going to deal with it. I can't risk like changing my voice, ruining the band if I can't sing. I'm just not going to do it. And then I was like, okay, I have to do it. And I just remember like texting Lolo, and it was like this big long message. And I was like, I know like you joined the band because you like the songs I sing and the way I sing, but my voice is going to change and I might ruin the band and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, dude, like it's fine. It's all good. And I was like, are you sure? He's like, yeah. So the whole time everyone's just kind of like, it's all good, whatever. And it luckily has been. So
yeah, that's interesting. You actually went right to one of the questions I had to, which, because I did notice, especially on Hollow, the difference of the voice, the progression of the difference of the voice. Is that, and is that why one of the reasons you're writing in lower keys now? Yeah,
because it's pretty crazy. My voice like did its like big like drop change while we were in the middle of a tour.
Wow.
And we like had played like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, like 4 days straight. And so by Friday, I could barely sing. And I was like, I don't know if I'm just tired. I don't know if I went too crazy yesterday. I don't know what's going on. And then our next show was on Sunday. So we had like Friday night all Saturday into Sunday. And so I was like, I'm just going to do vocal rest, not talk until then, be quiet. And then we got to the venue on Sunday, and as soon as I went to like speak at soundcheck, my voice was way different.
Oh man.
Oh no. But we just downtuned our guitars, and then we've just been playing in that tuning ever since, and it works.
Yeah. How I imagine the big change came between Fever Dreams and then you recording Hollow, right? Am I right? Because it does. I do hear the difference between those two specifically.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cool things about being in the studio is that you discover things about your voice which you may not. Because singing in live is such a different experience. You really get to hear who you are when you're in the studio. Yeah. Did you kind of come to understand how to deal with yourself like while recording that?
Yeah, recording vocals for Hollow was so awesome because I just like felt fully confident for the first time like ever recording vocals. I was like, I like how this sounds. Singing it is fun. Like I was just having a purely good time. And it has never felt like that before. I'm always humiliated to do vocals. Not anymore.
Wow, that's interesting. Do you feel that has, well, I guess it definitely has to do with your transformation. Yeah. Yeah. So hearing your voice now, does that sound more like how you feel you are?
Yeah. And it doesn't make me like all other albums that came out. I'm proud of them. I like the instrumentals. I do like the melodies. I just don't like how my voice sounds. And so, like, even before my voice changed, if people would, like, play Grimster around me, I'd be like, oh, I'm like, eh. Like, I do not want to hear that at all. But now I'm like, play it. I don't care. It's fine.
I guess part of that path is, once again, I was talking, I guess I'm into this now. Maybe I'm going through this, is being like, part of the confidence of changing is probably being comfortable with who you were at the same time, I would imagine. Yeah. Or else you just start living in rebellion and contrary instead of living a unique, or what do you call it, authentic life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely like something I've been like dealing with a lot recently. And I know the way I feel about things is going to shift in the future, 100%. But it's just like, I'm always thinking about just like the first two albums and people like learning about the band, and they go look it up immediately and it just sounds different right off the bat. Just drives me nuts. And I know that in like 5 years, it's going to be so cool to look back at the first two Grimster records. They sound completely different. Whoa. But right now it's just like so recent, and we sound so different right now with one song to prove. You know what I mean? So I'm just like, oh, so like, it is a cool thing and it will be cool looking back, but sometimes it makes me crazy.
Yeah. I just heard that one this morning when I went to take out the recycling. I finally listened to Hollow, and outside it reminded me, I mean, that's one of the cool things that a lot of people sing your band. It's like kind of like a bridge between the old Lookout Gilman days and what's going on now. You know, there's a nice little bridge, and that song did make me feel like that, especially with your voice. It was like, oh, this is kind of like the good stuff that Billy Joe does that I like. I do like Billy Joe. I think he's got an amazing voice, and
he does,
part of my tribe. So, you know, I like them, but I was really impressed with that sound that you had, like emulating but not being it at the same time.
John in the future here. Before we finish this up and we go into one of the last sections here, I want to say that I brought up a topic because of my interest in words and names, and was not aware or sensitive to the understanding of the complexity of moving from one name to another name. So after the interview was done, Donnie and I decided that we either would cut the section out or to bleep out Donnie's former name. I decided to leave the section in because I think it's a very interesting topic that Donnie was very honest about. And so here are some weird bleeps in the place of Donnie's old name.
Donnie, this is one of my other question I had during that's on this too, that I'm just curious, because this is more of my fascination with words and names. And so you went from to Donnie.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but like it means origin.
Does it?
And Donnie, like Donald, is a ruler of the world or a chief or a leader. So I like things like that. Like I've changed. I mean, I used to play with my writing name for playwright was Ian Pierce, which John Pearson is my name. But what I was trying to do is remove myself in theoretically or creatively remove myself from my parents, you know, like, or my, to try to be more objective. So Ian is the base of the name John. And Pierce is basically the son of Pierce, which means the people that were the bow and arrow people of the day. So I'm very into like the changing of a name and the intentional or unintentional reverberations it has.
<That's> pretty cool.
What do you mind say? I mean, is such a name that people wouldn't know is attached to male or female, but.
I just really associate it with everything that came before. And just like, I don't know, it just had to go. And it's funny too, because when I was like a little kid, and like my parents would like address me by name, I'd be like, stop calling me that. I'd be like, stop saying that. I was like, ew, no. So I know it is a pretty androgynous name. And a few people have said that, but yeah, just too attached to like other shit. I'm like, that person does not exist anymore.
Yeah. And what does the name Donnie, does it have any meanings for you?
It's silly. Because my middle name used to be Dawn, D-A-W-N. And I was like, I could just make my first name Dawn, but Dawn is also like a lady's name. And I was like, I could do Dawnie. And then I just like how it's spelled. So I spelled it like with the I-E. Ow, something has bit my leg.
Yeah, this, I'm sorry. Once again, these are just questions because I'm curious about name changes and stuff. Do you, is that another difficult thing to do to get people start calling you a new name? Or does, is it?
Oh, it was pretty easy. Yeah, everyone is really like respectful.
Yeah.
So small. Yeah, everyone is very respectful. And like, no one had trouble like adapting to it really. And it's just kind of like, I don't know, at first, if people get it wrong, they get it wrong. Like, you can't fault them for it. Overall, people were really good. And some of my friends don't even remember what my old name was, which is awesome.
And I mean, quite frankly, you're in an area where a lot of that evolution or revolution in the world to accept that stuff more is something you're in the heart of that area in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that moving?
I didn't.
Yeah.
Nope. I knew that there were like, there's so many gay people in San Francisco, but I didn't know we were all here too. Hallelujah.
You know what? You know what you did make me do, which I like a little bit of nostalgia. You don't want to live there your whole life, but it did make me review of when I first went to when we played Gilman Street we were actually supposed to play in 87, which was almost the first year, but we couldn't make it out. Then we played 88 with Operation Ivy.
Oh, nice. Wow.
So cool. Yeah. Because they actually came, we did a show, their one and only tour. They came to Chicago and we booked their show earlier that year. And Crim Shrine too. Those were the two bands that heavily influenced me and Ben. And then we drove from Chicago all the way to Berkeley for one show with Operation Ivy. And then went home.
We'd do that too.
So I have a soft spot in my heart for that venue.
it's perfect.
Yeah. So I guess my last question is the typical question: What's in the future for the band? And what?
Yeah. So in September we are going on tour with Jawbreaker and Joyce Manor. It's kind of a tour. It's like a bunch of shows. I don't know. A bunch of shows together is a tour in my eyes. So we're doing that. And then after that, we're doing some headline shows on the way home. And then we're going into the studio in November to record our third album.
Wow. I also think it's amazing to, once again, like bridging those gaps and of like, wow, playing with Jawbreaker. That's pretty great.
Crazy. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I remember when I first met them, we actually didn't play a show together. We just played in a playground. They came to visit us in Oakland. I think we were staying in Oakland and they came to visit us. I don't know, 89, somewhere around there, 80, 90. And we just played in a playground together.
Dude, playgrounds are awesome. Swing sets, I'm all about that. Yeah.
I know it's amazing how often we would end up in like some kind of playground or something with
it's
the band.
Always, it doesn't matter like what age you are, it's always fun. I went in a bounce house the other day. It was awesome.
A bounce house. Wow. Yeah.
Oh, pretty awesome.
my band Even in Blackouts played a Kid Zone, I think in Wyoming, and we played right in front of that habit trail thing, I call it, you know, where people and I like
I love those. Yes.
Yeah, we were crawling in it, but this one was tall. It was like two stories tall. And I actually climbed the outside of it with my guitar over my back, and my guitar fell and smashed to like pieces. And the whole audience went,
ah. Yeah, they're probably so excited. Yeah, terrible fall.
I see. Donnie, thank you so much for this.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, awesome. I really like the music, and I'm glad you were on the show to make time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, so when I hang up, it's really hanging up, so we'll say goodbye now.
Sure. All right, yeah. Nice to meet you.
Bye, Donnie. Bye-bye.
It's dark out again, no lights, no party. Go on ahead, it's fine, forget me.
If you have made it this far, you just got done listening to Hollow by Grumster, released by Pure Noise Records as a single in 2023. Thank you, everybody, for participating with your ears, contributing in your way to the longevity of this show. I really do appreciate it. I will keep this short. I will just say up next is, yes, the legendary Chicago musician, John Haggerty. We have a perfect, maybe even beautiful conversation, which I think you will enjoy. Also, remember, go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com and contribute however you can by joining the Patreon or giving a one-time donation at PayPal at jugheadsbasement@gmail.com. Or just sharing any of the episodes that you enjoyed, or just sharing the whole thing as a thing, a whole big thing, a thing that took 11 years to make into a thing, adding a T and an H and an I and a G, thing.